So, hi everybody, hi. Again, this is a question and answer session.
Can I sit here?
Sure, yeah.
I have a question.
Yeah.
What's the difference between a reincarnation and Yilgul? Is that the same thing?
It's the same thing.
Oh, it is the same thing.
Yeah, it's the same thing. Just,
What can you video saying?
Anyone has anything they'd like to discuss today, or? What about just generally?
Yeah, what's the proper way? I'm like, before I came to Israel, I knew that next year was going to be Shana Shemitah, so I was very worried about.
By the way, if you'd like to talk outside, feel free. You don't have to stay, really. I mean that genuinely. Okay. Yeah, you were saying about what?
Yeah, it really worried me. Like, I was afraid, like, if I go to the store, like, because there are stores that, like, maybe they do sell, you know, proper Shana Shemitah, but, like, there is no way of telling, like, on my side, like.
Well, I'll tell you this. You know, Shemitah, of course, has a few components. If you're a farmer, Shemitah has all sorts of restrictions on what you can do on the land, etc. If you're a consumer, you, in a way, have fewer questions, but the thing is, anything that grows during Shemitah has to be treated in a holy way. You know, you can't throw it away, you can't waste it. There'll be a special receptacle for Shemitah produce, etc. And, you know, the Israeli rabbinate relies on an old dispensation going back to the early 1900s, where all of the land is sold to non-Jews, and their shita is, their approach is, that just like you sell your chametz, that the laws of Shemitah don't apply. But most of the right-wing yeshiva community does not accept that concept. So my answer is very simple, though. In other words, any hashkacha that you would rely upon during the year, let's say the Be'edah Haredis, the Badatz, will also be sure that it'll be in full compliance with Shemitah, which means to say it'll either be imported or it'll be bought from Arabs, which is a controversial political issue. But you don't have to worry. In other words, the things that you rely upon for the whole year will be good for Shemitah as well. But that does mean you have to be extra careful, meaning any hashgacha that you would not trust during the year, you should not trust during Shemitah.
And on my consumer, on my side, I can't buy produce from Shemitah.
That's correct. Well, you can buy it, but it's bought in a special way. What that means basically is that in order to give farmers a living who don't participate in the Rabbanut sale to a non-Jew, what they do is the Jewish community through the Beis Din employs farmers as simply workers who work and gather the produce to be distributed at cost to people, and the worker gets a salary. So he's not getting money for the fruit, he's getting money for his labor. And these are special Shemitah stores that are called Otsar Beis Din. And if you buy in a special Shemitah store, which you're allowed to do, you have to keep all the laws of Shemitah. But if you buy in a regular store that's not designated as an Otsar Beis Din, it will either be imported produce from outside of Israel or Arab produce, in which case you do not have to keep the laws of Shemitah. So you have a choice. There'll be some designated stores that'll be Shemitah stores, which you are allowed to buy, and it might be a little cheaper, because you're only paying for the transportation and the salaries of the workers. There is no profit in the fruit, but then you have to keep all the laws of Shemitah. Or you can buy in a regular store something that's properly certified, in which case the Shemitah laws are not going to apply.
Is it better to eat from imported fruits from non-Jews?
Well, it's a little complicated. On one hand, if you buy an imported fruit, you are avoiding many, many questions.
Yeah.
That's right. So it's safer.
Yeah.
On the other hand, according to Ramban and other commentaries, there actually is a mitzvah to eat Shemitah fruit under the right conditions. So what I would recommend to you is that most of your purchases be the imported fruit. But every week or so, you buy one banana from a Shemitah store, so that way you get to keep that mitzvah. And it's not so hard to, you know, take care of one banana in a proper way. Okay? But I would think the bulk of your purchases should probably not be Shemitah fruit, because it would create too many unknown shilas. Okay? Again, the concept is, now if you follow the Rabbanut, the Israeli chief rabbinate, then you will buy even Shemitah fruit, but you will not treat it with Shemitah because it was grown in a that property that was sold to a non-Jew. But if you don't follow that Rabbanut, you should not do that.
There's like some places, I'm not sure, maybe they're Jewish, maybe they're not Jewish, like they grow in Israel, but like if it grows in the Golan, is it still permitted? Is it still treated?
Yeah, the Golan is treated as Shemitah. Where you get a problem is in the Negev. There are certain parts in the south that may not be within the boundaries of the biblical Eretz Yisrael, around Eilat, around there. And that's a big shaila, meaning some people are strict, some people are not strict. So I would tell you once again, avoid getting yourself into that. So if you follow, if you only get something under the supervision of the Eda Charedis, you know, that's the Badatz we call it, so you don't have to worry about Shemitah at all, because all of it will either be imported or straight from Arabs, and that's not going to be a problem.
So Arabs are completely not a problem.
That's correct, except in Bnei Brak. meaning, there's an ancient machlokas that goes back hundreds and hundreds of years between Rav Yosef Karo and the Mabit, Rav Moshe ben Yosef Trani, who were two contemporary Gedolim at the same time. Rav Yosef Karo's position is that any produce that grew on the land of non-Jews, even within Israel, does not have any Shemitah laws. Rav Moshe ben Yosef Trani, the Mabit, says that as long as it's in Israel, it does have Shemitah laws. Now, the way the halacha boils down to is the old minhag of Yerushalayim for hundreds and hundreds of years is we follow the view of Rav Yosef Karo, who says there's no Shemitah laws on Arab produce. But the Chazon Ish, who's followed in Bnei Brak, actually says there is. So, but once again, I mean, you know, you're certainly entitled to follow the Psak of Yerushalayim. This is an old Psak, and this is Rav Yosef Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch. So certainly that would be regarded as authoritative. Okay, so the bottom line is, you can safely buy Arab produce, and don't worry about the Shemitah laws. Now, the political problem with Arab produce is, well, you're giving money to Arabs. What do Arabs do with the money you give them? You know, we unfortunately are beginning to see what they do with the money. So some people feel it's very, very wrong to give money to Arabs. So, you know, I'll leave that to your conscience. I will say that if it's imported, then it's not Arabs. It might be America, it might be England, it might be France. That's okay. But you're not always going to know. But if it has the seal of the Eda Charedis, you know that it's not a Shemitah problem. But you don't know why it's not a Shemitah problem, but it will not be a Shemitah problem.
But like if you say to yourself, God forbid, like I don't want to break Shemitah, and like you don't even want to come close to like ever doing something like that, that would be the best thing to do is with imported fruits, right?
Yes. But as I say, a lot of the fruits that are certified as kosher for Shemitah are in fact imported fruits. That's exactly what they do.
And I could go into any field and take Shemitah fruit?
Yes. Shemitah, any Jewish field. Shemitah, everything is ownerless. So I could walk into your field and take apples, etc. And I don't even have to take off Truma and Maser during Shemitah. Right? It's Hefker. I don't have to take tithing. And if the owner tries to stop me, he transgresses a commandment in the Torah. The Torah prohibits him from stopping me. But let me point out, if it is from a Jewish field, you have to keep the Shemitah laws, meaning it can't go to waste. You know, there are special laws of how you eat Shemitah fruit. You don't put it into regular garbage. There's a special designated receptacle only for Shemitah fruit. So yeah, you can go into any field you want, but if it's not imported or it's not from Goyim, you have to keep all the laws of Shemitah.
I've got a question. Yeah. Any produce in the Shemitah year, can you, instead of saying, reduce waste, can you store it and then eat it in a later year, or does it have to be eaten in that Shemitah year?
So here's another thing about Shemitah you need to know. There is a very important thing that happens in the eighth year, the year after Shemitah, that's very, very relevant, and that is the Torah permits you to eat Shemitah fruit only as long as there's still produce in the fields that are available for animals. At a point in which everything from the field is gone, you have to get rid of your Shemitah fruit by declaring it ownerless and throwing it out. Now, this typically does not happen in the seventh year. This typically happens in the eighth year, meaning to say, let's say apples, right? You have apples that grow on trees during Shemitah. you can eat those apples, they're hefker, I can go into your field, take the apples, but I'm only allowed to keep those Shemitah apples as long as there's still Shemitah apples on trees that animals could take. At whatever point there are no longer any Shemitah apples on the trees, I would have to take out my Shemitah apples, I would have to be mafkir them. Now, then I could take them back again, it's true, but I have to go through a hefker, and if I didn't do that, it becomes forbidden to eat. So you may wonder, well, how am I supposed to know what date that is? The answer is that over the years, poskim and agriculturalists have given dates, and they'll tell you. I don't know the apple date. I have to check, and it may vary with the season. But it may say something like, you can eat Shemitah apples until Hanukkah of the year after Shemitah. That would be a typical thing like that. Meaning, so the short answer is, you can store it for later use, but only as long as it is still available for animals, and there will be certain dates that you will be given. There'll be a calendar of dates, and those dates will not be in the seventh year. The seventh year, typically, the fruits are still available. It's typically in the middle of the eighth year that there's going to be a problem. And everything is different. Apples have one time, and plums have another time, and grapes have another time. And to me, it's amazing they can come up with an exact date. It really doesn't make sense to me, but I don't know agriculture, that every single year it's going to be at a certain date, everything disappears for the animals. But apparently they're able to be fairly accurate as to when it's not available for the animals. You understand that idea? So that would be one thing to be aware of. Because if you didn't make it hefker by the animal date, it actually becomes forbidden to eat. And you're not allowed to eat it at all.
Could you not redeem it by giving portion
of it? No. Shemitah is not redeemable, per se. Meaning it's not like other things, like Maser Sheni, that can be redeemed. Now, Shemitah does have one aspect of redemption, and that is, if I take Shemitah produce, and I sell it to you for money, the money now has the holiness of Shemitah, and I have to use that money to buy food that I will eat with the laws of Shemitah. But it doesn't take off the holiness of the original fruit. It transfers it onto the money, but the original fruit still remains holy. Okay? So Shemitah is quite complicated, but as I say, in terms of your immediate problem, if you buy from the Eid HaRedes, it is either imported or Arab, and therefore you have no problem. If you buy from the Shemitah store or you go into somebody's field and you take, you're allowed to do that too. But then you have to keep the Shemitah laws, including the not wasting and including being mafkarit again when it's no longer available for the animals. So you have to be conscious of those.
Getting rid of it.
Yeah, basically you either eat it or sometime in the eighth year you have to get rid of it. Although, as I say, it's really a symbolic hefker because you take it outside, you declare it's hefker, and then you can take it back in again. In other words, you don't have to leave it outside, but you have to go through this mitzvah of being mafkir. This is called bior, beis yud ayin vav resh. Bior, that is getting rid of the Shemitah produce. But most of the time, you're not going to, well, I tell you where you do have a problem. I mean, most of the time, fruit, you're not going to keep that long. I mean, you're not going to keep fruit from Shemitah until Chanukah of the eighth year. But I'll tell you where you have a problem. If you have things like wine, bottles of wine. Now, if you buy an imported bottle of wine or an Arab bottle, well, the bottle of wine made by Arabs, you couldn't have because that would be trade, right? So if it's imported from America, that's fine. But if it's Shemitah wine, which you can get at the Osher Beis Din, you have to be sure not to keep it till the date in which grapes are chayav in bior. Meaning, at some point in the eighth year, you will not be allowed to have that wine again unless you were mafkarit and then reacquired.
Raisins are dried fruits.
Same thing. So raisins will be, or the same thing, raisins will be subject to zamanim of bior. So I'm sure, I can get you this probably, but, you know, you can find it yourself. There will be online zamanim calendars for bior in the eighth year for all of the different fruits and the like. Now, one other thing about Shemitah you need to know, although, again, if you have reliable supervision, they take this worry out of your head, so you don't have to worry about it, but just for your knowledge, that although on Shemitah I'm allowed to eat the fruits that grow in the trees, but if grains or vegetables grow even if they were not planted, they just the leftover seeds, there's an issur d'rabbanan for me to eat them. Why is it, I can't eat them at all. That's called sapichim, things that grow by themselves. And the reason that's prohibited is, it's a rabbinic decree, that since grain and vegetables are commonly planted every year, if we would let you eat the grain that grows by itself, you might deliberately plant something and then claim, oh, it just grew by itself. So in order to take away any chashash that you would go ahead and plant, we categorically aser. Which means, in other words, let me point out this way, when you go to the Shemitah store, you will find in the Shemitah store apples, oranges, fruits, bottles of wine. You will not find bread. You will not find any grain products or any vegetables, because it's not possible to have vegetables that you're permitted to eat. In other words, the only vegetables you're permitted to eat are going to be imported or Arab vegetables. They will not be. There is no such thing, in other words, as Shemitah vegetables. Because d'oraisa there is, d'oraisa there is. But rabbinically, this is a gezeira called sapichim. Okay, so you will not find any vegetable that was grown during Shemitah in Israel that you will be allowed to eat, unlike fruits that are hefker. Okay, so as I say, I would urge everybody to at least buy like one Shemitah fruit a month so they could fulfill the mitzvah without being overwhelmed with how difficult it is. Yeah.
I heard some people buy like a small plot of land, like 1 square foot, like something like that, just to say, you know, like I did.
That's a good idea, actually. You know, I'm not sure if you could. I'm wondering. There's probably some businessman that's doing this because it sounds like a smart idea. Hey, you can buy your square inch of land, but it actually is a good idea because there are so many mitzvahs that we're not able to do if we don't own land. For example, the mitzvah of not farming my land. I don't have if I don't own any land. And so that would be an idea. I haven't seen advertisements, but I'm sure some business person is thinking of it. And the like, you know, they sell stars. You can buy a star, right? So if you can buy a star, you certainly should be able to buy some land in Israel.
If the fruit grows like during, like, more, like for example, the dates out there, right? Like, assuming that someone owned that tree.
Yeah.
If it grew like into the Shemitah, like it's not ripe now, but it'll ripen.
Okay, so that's a very good question. Meaning, when does something belong to the Shemitah year? That's the thing. So we have separate rules for fruits and for grain and for vegetables. Fruits belong to the Shemitah year based on when the tree produced a bud. Now, let's look at an apple tree. If you have an apple tree, so it produces some flowers, and then the flowers drop, and there's a little bud. And out of that bud, the fruit grows. So budding, now that's an interesting thing, meaning even if 85% of the apple grew during Shemitah, if the bud was before Shemitah, it's not a Shemitah apple. If it budded after Shemitah, even if it was the very end of Shemitah and 90% of it grew after Shemitah, it is a Shemitah apple. So it's very important. You're not looking at what year most of the growth took place. You're looking at what year the budding took place. Now, with grain, in terms of sapichim, that you're not allowed to eat grain, there it's defined that it had one-third of its growth. If it reached one-third of its growth during Shemitah, even if two-thirds afterwards, it's a Shemitah growth. If one-third is before Shemitah, even if two-thirds during Shemitah, it's not Shemitah. So that's a very important issue, that not everything that grows during Shemitah has the laws of Shemitah. It depends on what stage of growth that it had. But as I say, once again, you know, since you're not a farmer, you're not going to be in the field, you're not going to know any of this, so you have to rely on the rabbis that are certifying the product, that if they say there's no Shemitah problem, they have determined it's either imported. We now have three possibilities: imported, Arab, or the budding of the fruit took place before Shemitah. And that's why you'll see, you can actually see pictures of rabbis looking at trees and looking at buds, you know, they're actually looking at seeing how much of it took place. Yeah.
We hear that Hashem takes care of us in that he sends double or more the amount of rain so that we can cover the Shemitah period, and then when that's over, there'll be enough. The ground will be rich enough for the next bit of stuff to grow nicely. Now we've had a very bad drought year. How does this work?
Well, it's not Shemitah yet, right? But you know, God says in the Torah that when people will say, "How will we survive during Shemitah? We're not allowed to plant. We're not allowed to harvest," and God says, "I will give you a special blessing that you will harvest in the sixth year, enough to cover the sixth and the seventh, and then you'll even have enough to go into the eighth." Now, the truth of the matter is, you're correct that this year has not been extremely fertile. But, you know, number one, we're not at the end of the year yet. But number two, there are other ways that God's bracha takes place. Sometimes God's bracha takes place that even Shemitah itself produces huge crops of fruit, even though there's so little that we can do. We have many stories. You know, again, you know, I don't like just tell stories about miracles because, you know, some people make up these stories. But these are true stories, really. And that is about two farms, one next to each other, one didn't keep Shemitah, one was not religious, and they did everything. They fertilized, and they did all the stuff you do. And there was a drought, and the field did not produce. And the other farmer was a Shemitah farmer who didn't fertilize and didn't water, and his trees produced huge yields of fruit. So next to each other, one right next to each other, and one gets blessed with God's blessing, and the other does not get blessed. So the truth is, even during Shemitah, there can be tremendous blessings. What do farmers do during Shemitah? Well, there are a few things. Some literally go to Kollel for a year, and we raise money to help them and the like. Others essentially become employees of the Yotzer Beis Din, meaning to say they'll still harvest the fruit, but they're not harvesting it as their own fruit. They're harvesting it on behalf of the Jewish people, and they get reimbursed as employees for their time and their effort. So their daily schedule might be somewhat the same. Now, let me point out that even if they're harvesting on behalf of the Jewish people, they cannot do all of the agricultural labor they commonly do. They can do enough to prevent the crop from dying. But they're not supposed to use a lot of fertilizer. They're not supposed to do things to enhance the crop. But they can do it to ensure the survivability of the crop, right? That's kind of the concept. And then you have to break down what activities are you allowed to do and what not. So it turns out there's quite a lot of agricultural activities that can be done during Shemitah, as long as it's in the nature of survival as opposed to enhancement. So if you water your trees every day, so during Shemitah you do it twice a week. Things like that, those kind of differences. But things like fertilizing you don't do because that's just extra stuff. Okay, so it should be exciting to be here for Shemitah. I don't think I was ever here for a Shemitah year. I think not. So it'll be my first Shemitah also. So it'll be good to learn how to do it in action.
Does the big stores have Chayes Haredim? See, that's called shop, let's say.
Okay, I'm not sure. Obviously, it depends on your neighborhood. You know, if you're in a Haredi neighborhood like here, or like Geula or Mea Shearim, then obviously you're going to have Eda Charedis. If you go to Rechavia, it's going to be a little harder. The chain supermarkets, Supersol, the other big chains, typically don't have Eda Charedis, but some do. I think Rami Levi Mahadran, you know, there are Mahadran versions of things that will have it. But I would really highly recommend that you look for Eda Charedis fruit for Shemitah. Otherwise, you have, or you know, Lavdavka, I mean, or Reuben, or whatever. I mean, what's called a Mahadran Hashgacha. And the Mahadran Hashgachas that you use during the year would be good for Shemitah, too. Okay? All right.
What about gardening?
Oh, okay, so that's very important. If you are a gardener, you are a farmer. You have to keep all the balachas of Shemitah. So you can't plant. You normally cannot fertilize.
Even flowers
have the laws of Shemitah. You cannot weed unless the weeding is such that you think it would kill the plants, and then you can weed enough, right? You water your plants enough to keep them alive. So if you're doing it every day, do it twice a week or three times a week, and again, you talk to experts. Now, what is an enormously interesting and complicated question is, how do you apply Shemitah to gardening in flower pots? That's actually interesting. If it's planted in the ground, the dirt itself, then it's simple. The laws of Shemitah apply. But when it's in a flower pot and it's not directly in the ground, or let's say, especially if it's in a flower pot in your apartment, it's in the house or on the marpeset, it's not on the ground itself, how does Shemitah apply there? And that's very, very tricky. We paskin that if the flower pot is an earthenware flower pot, then if it's on the ground, it's treated as if it's connected to the ground, even though it's in a flower pot, and all the laws of Shemitah apply. If, on the other hand, it's in your apartment, in your house, then Shemitah doesn't apply.
Earthenware.
Huh? Yes, even if it's earthenware. But if it's on your marpeset, it's very tricky. It depends if there's a roof over your marpeset or there's not a roof. If there's no roof over your marpeset, let's say there's no balcony above you, then the laws of Shemitah would apply, even though it's five stories up. If, on the other hand, it's roofed, I treat a roofed mirpeset with, you know, a balcony above it the same as a house, in which the laws of Shemitah don't apply. So you have to be very, very careful. In other words, even a potted plant might have the laws of Shemitah. Now,
Sukkah that's been left there.
Yes. So a sukkah would count as a roof. And that would permit you to cultivate plants in the planter or in the flower pot. If there is no roof, then you have to treat it like it's on the ground, and that would be forbidden. Okay? Yeah.
I used to, my dad would burn tomatoes, and I think he still does it in the United States. And I watched some farms are, they're hydroponic.
Yeah.
It's like tables like this. It's not even on the ground. It's tables like this, and you know the tomatoes grow.
Yeah. So hydroponic produce is produce that is grown in mixtures of water and minerals without soil. And there are a lot of shadows about hydroponics. First of all, what bracha do you make? It's interesting. Let's say a tomato. Right. So normally on a tomato you make the bracha, borei pri ha'adama. He created the fruit from the ground. Vegetables are fruits from the ground. Hydroponic is not from the ground. It's not from soil. What bracha do you make? Some people say you make shahakol. Some people say that since the species of tomatoes is a vegetable, so you make adama even if this particular one isn't. Then you have the question of Shemitah, right? Am I allowed to grow hydroponic vegetables? Right? So what's tricky is this. According to strict halacha, if it's hydroponic, it is not subject to the laws of Shemitah, and therefore it's mutter to grow, and it's mutter to eat, and you don't have to follow any of the Shemitah laws. But there is a problem that not all hydroponics are created equal. In many hydroponics, what you actually have is you actually have a bag of soil, meaning it's not in the ground, but there's a bag of soil mixed with nutrients and minerals. So in that situation, it actually is growing in detached soil. So it's not in the ground, and then it would be similar to the flower pot problem. So you have to see, is it a hydroponic without soil?
In a greenhouse.
Right. So if it's in a greenhouse, again, a greenhouse is like a house. If it's hydroponic in a greenhouse, then it would appear to be analogous to a flower pot in your house. And the Shemitah laws would not apply. That's correct. Unless it's actually planted in the soil itself, which it probably will not. Well, it won't be. No. But you're correct. Hydroponics is one of the ways we can produce things without violating the laws of Shemitah. So it is an important technology.
Is it common in Israel?
It's not extremely common, but it's growing. It's because it's expensive. Hydroponic is an expensive produce. So at least on a large scale. You can do it, you know, small scale. Every person could do it himself. But to do it commercially in large amounts costs a lot of money, so hydroponic would be more expensive. But they're doing more and more of it. And it is a great way to, I hate to say get around Shemitah, but it's a great way to be able to augment the food supply without violating the laws of Shemitah. Yeah, that's correct. Okay, any...
We had a class before with Rabbi Ullman.
Yes.
We were discussing some Gemara about the rewards and the punishment you get if your father was evil and you're good, or if your father was good and you're evil, and there's a whole different continuum of
how it works.
And I was thinking, just as we left, I didn't have time to ask him, what about the other way around? What happens when you're a father and you have a son? And whatever you've been, you want to teach your son to be a mensch. In other words, how does that transfer the other way?
Meaning,
what rewards are you getting?
In other words, what rewards does a parent get?
What merit?
Well, there's no question. Listen, we know, of course, when somebody dies, a son should say Kaddish for a parent for 11 months, and we say, talk about doing mitzvahs, and we have a very common phrase, the neshama should have an aliyah. What does that mean? The soul should be elevated. We have a very, very strong belief that the children, my grandchildren, the people I leave behind, the good things they do give me spiritual benefit in Shemayim. And the reason is, if they're doing it because of me, either because I taught them or they're just doing it for my merit, I am the reason they're doing it. If I'm the reason they're doing it, God will judge me favorably. That's why the idea that you're judged for all of your deeds is not only at the moment that you die. Every single second you're judged, because the ripple effects of your good deeds or your bad deeds continue to reverberate throughout time. If your great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren is doing mitzvahs because of the chinuch you gave your children, in Shemayim, that's a constant source of merit. Conversely, to be give you the negative side of it, if I turn somebody off from Yiddishkeit, I have all of the averos that all of their descendants do that wouldn't have happened had I not turned them off. We have infinite responsibility for the negative consequences that were caused by anything we did, and we have infinite reward for the positive consequences that we caused.
I once asked a rabbi about kibud avim, respect your father and your mother, okay, after they're gone. And he looked at me, absolutely. So
yes.
In other words, when they're alive and when they're not alive.
Now, the Gemara says explicitly, the mitzvah of kibud avim is even after they're dead. Absolutely, absolutely. And So merit is a continuous thing. You know, you never know the ripple effects. And it's a funny thing. It says that after 120 years, when we have to give an accounting of our lives, it's a funny thing. We look back and we think, what were the most important things I did? And we might have an image. And we might be surprised to learn that what we thought was so tremendously important really didn't amount to too much. And things we thought were inconsequential or, you know, nothing, we didn't even remember them, they become our ticket to Olam Haba. I'm sure you've had this experience. Certainly rabbis have this all the time, where somebody might go over to you and say, you know, thanks so much for what you told me. You know, it changed my life. Now, you don't remember what it was. You don't remember the person or remember the conversation. It was not something that struck you as memorable or really significant. But at that moment in their life, that was so important. On the other hand, you know, you could give classes and lectures and long, long things that you think, you know, gee, you know, I really did something great here. Okay, you know, maybe it helped people, maybe it didn't. So we really don't have a sense of what is the good that we've done with our lives and what is the bad that we've done with our lives.
Why doesn't Hashem give us an indication? Then you'll know where to go.
Well, part of it is, you know, you got to try to do what's right, not because you're getting brownie points for it. You know, you just do what's right because it's right. And we stumble through, you know, but every once in a while we get to see. You know, I'll give you a story. So it's actually, it's a famous little story they tell about, you know, Dallas, Texas has a kollel. Dallas, Texas is not such an Orthodox city, but they have some rabbis who give classes. And there was a fellow who had not been religious at all. But after a trip to Jerusalem, he started becoming more and more religious. And shortly after he returned, like 6 months after he returned, he died of a sudden heart attack. But he left like $10 million to this kollel because he thought that this is where he wanted his money to go. Now, it turned out, what was the story? Like, what changed him? What was his epiphany? What was his transformation? He went to the Western Wall, and he sees some Hasidish guy davening. And he was so moved by how fervent the person was, how sincere he was, how devoted he was. He didn't meet the guy. He didn't talk to the guy. The guy didn't see him. He just said to himself, this is where I'm going to leave my fortune. This is the people I want to help. This is the cause I want to be connected to. So he leaves $10 million, he dies. Now, imagine after 120 years, this Hasidic guy dies. And the angels say to him, oh, you're going to get such reward. Because of you, somebody gave $10 million of charity. What are you talking about? I never saw this guy. I don't know who this guy is. What is that to do? But somebody saw you. Somebody saw you. Somebody changed. And that's a lot of the times. You know, people watch you sometimes. Especially if you wear a yarmulke, you know, you try to be a religious Jew. And the little things you are, you know, how friendly you are, how you talk to people, are you rude, are you pushy, or vice versa? Do you try to be kind or considerate? It might just be a one-to-one interaction, but there might be somebody who sees, and, you know, et cetera. And you never know. Ripple effects are amazing. The ripple effects of the little actions we do, for good or for bad, just have so much far-reaching consequences that it can be unbelievable. You know? So we've got to be careful, and we've got to try to live a life that when people look at us, they'll say, oh, being a Jew is a good thing. Right? That's what it means to say, you shall love the Lord your God, we say in Shema. So the Gemara says in Maseches Yuma, make the name of God beloved in others. That's what it means to love God. That people should look at you and say, oh, if that's what a religious Jew is, that's a good thing. And if people look at you and they say, oh, if that's what a religious Jew is, ugh, then you've done the opposite. You've desecrated Hashem's name. So it's not so much whether they become religious or not, but they should look at a Torah Jew and say, that's a good thing. And that's called sanctification of God's name. That is called making the name of God beloved. And the great Rebbe Yashiv said that he thought that this was the central mission of the Jew in this century before Mashiach, is to try to make the name of Hashem beloved among others. Okay? So it's a good mission. We all should try to accomplish it to whatever degree we can. Have a good Shabbos, a good day, and be loved.